The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
G'day everyone and welcome to City Bible Forum. I'm Craig Josling. It's a great privilege to be able to meet here, to use this venue, to have a great speaker, and to get some time off from work. So, just to let you know what will happen if this is your first meeting with us, I'm going to read one of the Bible passages that Al will be referring to today inside your program, just in a minute. Then Al will get up, speak for 20, 25 minutes. Then there'll be a chance for you to ask questions, and you can do that via this slip of paper. Inside your program, you'll see pens on the tables, and Al will have a crack at answering your questions or your responding to your comments. All right, well, if you'd like to open up your program, the topic of today's talk is The Points of Difference, Politics, A Different Approach. And I'll be reading from Mark chapter 12, verses 13 to 17. Later they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know that you're a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?" But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. "Why are you trying to trap me?" he asked. "Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." They brought the coin and he asked them, "Whose image is this and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then Jesus said to them, "Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." And they were amazed at him.
Oh, good afternoon. Hope you're having a good day so far. Now, there's two topics you really need to be careful talking about, or to be kind of in polite Australia, and that would be politics and religion. Today, we're going to talk about both and how they combine. So, we'll see what happens. When I say politics, I know there's, you know, there's office politics and the way we relate and so on. What I mean simply, though, is the way people are governed and so on. So here's a definition of politics from the Oxford Dictionaries. The activities associated with the governance of a country or area, especially the debate between parties having power. Now, my guess is that most people would say that politics and religion should not mix. But you don't bring the two together. If you do, you get an ugly cocktail. You can see why people think that. So the way, you know, the way often that politics and religion mix, say, you know, in the Middle East, when you get religious persecution from governments and so on, you can see that happen. Or even the way, say, the religious right is portrayed in the USA. I'm not close enough to know what really goes on, but what you can see in so much of our media, as the religious right is shown, it's almost never shown in a good light. Now, an answer to that is that many people would say all religious values are private and should not be taken into the public square. So you don't bring your, you shouldn't bring your religious values into the public square in terms of political debate and so on. Keep them private. Politics should be a religion-free zone. Is that right? Well, let's kind of drill down a little bit more. If you're a follower of Jesus, how should you vote? I guess the first question is, should you vote? And then how should you vote? And which party should you vote for? Okay. Or if you're a Christian and you want to go into politics, which side of politics should you be in or on? And what do you do with your faith? Do you take it into the public square with you? Let's see if we can answer some of these questions. In 20 minutes, let me give you some things to think about. We've got a little series happening now from Mark's Gospel about making a difference. And today we're looking at the idea of Jesus and politics or government. And I think you'd be, if we stop and think, Jesus has had a massive influence on the way that we think politics should operate and the way the government should operate and those in authority. Now today I just want to look at one small story, the one that Craig read for us. It's in Mark's Gospel, where Jesus says, well, something that made the crowds amazed and has affected our society as well. To put it in context, we've been working our way through Mark's Gospel. We're up to Mark chapter 12. A few weeks ago, the last story we looked at was when Jesus cleansed the temple. By that I mean... Now, Craig, have we got the next the slide, please, mate? That's it. Now, there's an artist's reconstruction of what the temple, Herod's temple, would have looked like at the time of Jesus. Massive. The courts around the temple were, the size of a dozen football fields, something like that. And they, at Passover time, they were full of people making money out of exchanging coins and selling sacrificial animals and so on. And Jesus saw the greed and so on in operation, and he threw the people out of the temple. It's the idea of cleansing the temple. And now, day by day, in this week before Jesus is crucified, he's teaching in the temple courts. And so speaking to a large crowd of people, as you kind of imagine that. Now, you have a look at the part of the Bible that's printed out in your program, Mark chapter 12 from verse 13. Mark tells us, later they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. That they would be the religious leaders, the national leaders of Israel. And you notice, if you were a first century person, you'd look at that sentence and say, the who together? Now, it doesn't hit us because it's so far away in time and so on, but the Pharisees and the Herodians, well, it's a little bit of the case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I don't know, it sounds like the mafia said that. I don't know where it came from, okay? But the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That the Herodians and the Pharisees hated each other in the political realm. Why? Well, they were at either end of the political spectrum. The Pharisees were the kind of true blue Jewish nationalists who loved the Old Testament and set out to be deeply religious, deeply Jewish, and hated the occupying Romans. At the other end of the political spectrum were the Herodians, and you can see where the name comes from, as in those who followed King Herod. They were the ones who'd sold out to the Romans and accommodated and were happy to kind of fit in and work with the Romans and so on. So totally opposite ends of the political spectrum. What brings them together? They both hated and feared Jesus as he stirred up trouble and exposed their hypocrisy and the crowd's love to hang on Jesus' words and so on. And so they come to him with an unanswerable question. Look at how they set it up. See verse 14. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?" And you see how they begin to paint him into a corner, and that is to say, well, Jesus, we know that you're not one of those kind of slippery spin doctor types. We know that you answer questions directly because you see what the way the New International Version translates it, you pay no attention to who they are. Literally what the original says is, you don't look on the face of people, meaning you don't show favouritism. Jesus spoke without fear or favouritism and told the truth. Now, here's the irony. They're trying to set him up so he has to answer, but everything they say is, of course, true. And you notice how they're pushing him down with a complex, difficult question. They're pushing him down to a yes or no answer. An old kind of debating technique. Well, which is it? Yes or no? And so that's what they're trying to do. Now, a couple of little bits of kind of background information, if you like. As you see verse 14, they mention the imperial tax. This isn't just any old tax from the Romans or from the Jewish leaders and so on. This is a tax that was introduced by the Roman emperor or the Roman administrators in 6 AD. It was a tax of one denarius. And here's a picture of a denarius. In fact, we still have these coins. Each of them was minted with the image or the face of the current Roman emperor on it. It was a tax of one denarius. And basically, denarius was a day's pay for a labourer. Okay, one day's pay. It was a tax on every adult male in the nation, basically for the privilege of being a subject of Caesar. So every adult male had to pay it regardless, and it meant I am a subject of Caesar, and the locals hated it. Actually, did I just mention? No, I don't think I did. We have many, many of these coins around, and I think you can buy one of these on eBay for around $500 if you want. So, yeah, they still exist. When the Romans bought this tax in, there was a revolt about 25 years earlier, about 6 AD, by a man called Judas the Galilean. It's mentioned very briefly in the book of Acts, that's Luke's second volume, but Josephus, the Jewish historian who wrote just after the great wars of Rome, kind of towards the end of the first century, tells us this about Judas the Galilean. There was one Judas, a Galilean of the city, whose name was Gamala, who, taking with him Zadok, a Pharisee, became zealous to draw them to a revolt. Both said that this taxation, this particular tax brought in by Caesar, was no better than the introduction to slavery, and exhorted the nation to assert their liberty. So he began a rebellion. From what I understand, he also cleansed the temple, and then talked about bringing, you know, the kingdom of God and so on, and was, of course, crushed by Rome. The New Testament tells us that he was defeated and killed. And Josephus tells us later that his two sons were also crucified sometime later. So Rome was brutal on political dissent. You know, you have little leeway about religion, but boy, when it came to political loyalty and money and so on, no mercy. And so they come to Jesus and say, well, Jesus, you're saying all these kind of revolutionary things. Which is it? And you see how it's a loaded question. That is, if Jesus, they say, should we pay the tax or not? If Jesus says, well, no, don't pay the tax, the Herodians, up goes the hand, Rome will come and crush him. It would be inevitable. But if he says, well, yes, pay the tax to Caesar and so on, then the Pharisees would say, well, all this revolutionary stuff you talk about, all this kingdom of God stuff and so on, it's really just, what, smoke and mirrors. It amounts to nothing. And he'd lose all his popular support from the populace that hated the tax. So there's no answer to it, really. But yes, there is. See verse 15. But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. That is, they're not genuinely asking him, they're trying to trap him. The hypocrisy. Why are you trying to trap me, he asked. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. They bought the coin and he asked them, whose image is this? Whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. And so there's a picture, once again, the denarius. Now, on that denarius, if we could translate it, the inscription says this, Tiberius Caesar, son of the god Augustus. Tiberius Caesar, son of the god Augustus. So Augustus Caesar, his father. This man is claiming to be the son of God. Now, I don't know if you'd noticed, it took me a little while to see it, and that is, there's actually two kings in this story. Two men who are both claiming to be the son of God. One is Caesar and the other Jesus. And how will these two men that are claiming to be the son of God, how do they relate to each other? Or how do the followers of one relate to the other? And what is it that Jesus says? Verse 17, then Jesus said to them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And they were amazed at him. What's he say? Look, give it to Caesar. It's got his image on it anyway. And in those days, they actually believed, well, I guess it was true, that Caesar himself owned all the coins. So look, you've got coins in your pocket. They belong to Caesar anyway. What's the big deal about giving them to him? And of course, we'll come back in a moment, give to God what is God's. Now, that's just one little sentence, but it's got huge implications for the way you think about how following Jesus, how you relate and so on to political power and how that all works. Jesus claimed to be a king, in fact, God's king, and yet Jesus says that his kingdom is not of this world. I don't know if you've read in John's Gospel where Jesus is on trial before Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, and Jesus says to Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my followers would fight to prevent my arrest. But my kingdom is from another place. And so Jesus teaches all the time about his kingdom, and yet what does he mean? Well, Jesus' kingdom will not grow by political force or armies or political action. It'll be as his message is explained to people, as they believe in him, as they find forgiveness and come to know God through him as their king. That's how Jesus' kingdom will grow. And it'll begin small, he says, like a mustard seed, and it'll fill the earth. And one day, when he comes back and it's all completed, it will transform creation. That's the agenda of the kingdom of God. And actually, if you've got eyes to see it, it's happening now. Right? It's happening around the world and so on, as people believe and come to know God through Jesus, their king. In the meantime, Jesus, how would you put it, endorses the idea of secular government. And when I say secular, that's not the same as saying atheistic. Okay, so you can lead a secular government and be a Christian, you can lead a secular government and be an atheist. What secular means is belonging to this age or of this world. So a government that will operate and run and care for and do things in this age. That's the idea of secular. Okay. Now, there's a change. Let me see if I can get this right. In the Bible, there's a change from the idea of theocracy in the Old Testament to this idea of a secular government in the New Testament. I'll see if I can show you on the kind of a diagram here. You're right, Craig. Theocracy. Here's a good definition. A theocracy is a political unit governed by a deity or by officials thought to be divinely guided. In other words, God runs the government, and those who are in authority kind of have God's guidance and will be, you know, infallible in a way. All right. So the way that a quick kind of sweep of the Bible, in about 1300 BC, around about that, God uses the great prophet Moses to bring the people of Israel out of Egypt and brings them to the promised land. And as God brings them in, the idea is that God will be their king, and God will give them laws, and God will appoint the rulers, and they'll walk with him, and God himself will be king over the nation. Then the people ask for a king like the other nations, kings who are eventually called the sons of God, and so on. But the next, it's from about 1300 through to about 600, it's just basically a history of failure, where no one is actually up to the ability to lead a theocracy. Kind of the kings fail one after another until finally God takes them all into exile in Babylon. But at the same time, during that 700 years or so, the prophets in Israel, the ones who come and write, particularly maybe the prophet Isaiah, begin to say, there is no justice, God's kingdom isn't being ruled properly, God himself will come and bring salvation. God himself will come and bring the kingdom of God. And so when that happens, when God turns up, you get Jesus who arrives and says he's come to bring the kingdom of God, but it won't be a political kingdom. And at the same time, he says, in the meantime, you need to work with, submit to, follow secular governments. Now, the New Testament is actually generally positive about the idea of governments and human government. In your outline, on the right-hand side, is Romans chapter 13. So that's the Apostle Paul writing to the Christians in Rome. And once again, this is against the background of, you know, the Roman Empire, the emperors, etc., who were, how can we put it, to say the least, patchy in how they governed. Listen to what he says. Now, this is, if you like, the general statement about governments. And then there's qualifications elsewhere, okay? But this is the general positive statement. Let me read it for you and just get the vibe of it anyway. He says this, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it's necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honour, then honour. So governments are placed there by God, and governments should rule, whatever faith or religion or whatever, governments should rule for the good of all their citizens. Okay? Now, I think, and I guess actually preparing this week has made me realise, I guess, how I need to think and read about this a whole lot more. But as I read the New Testament, there's no reason why this positive view of government couldn't apply to monarchy, why it couldn't apply even to a benign dictatorship. Okay, we have the great privilege of living in a democracy where we have great freedom, and those things have developed out of the Western world. I think you make a very strong argument that it's a Christian worldview that has helped contribute significantly to the rise of this freedom and so on. Why? The belief in the equality of people before God and before the law has come out of a Christian worldview. The idea that those who make the laws are under the laws themselves comes out of a Christian worldview. And the idea that political power should be used to serve those that you lead is another teaching of Jesus. What I can't do is point you to the particular book that gives all that history. In a moment, you might be able to tell me what I should read or what's the book that says that. All right. Now, you see what Jesus is saying just in this, just those couple of sentences? One is that governments, generally, it's positive, yes, but they're not ultimate. Government is positive, but not ultimate. So what does he say? But give to God what is God's. And that is, he limits the power of governments. Governments are put there by God and in some ways are servants of God to bring justice, yes, but they are not God. Now, that's unusual in the ancient world. So you can see that Caesar Augustus and so Tiberius Caesar thought of themselves as God. The Egyptian pharaohs, just quite blatantly, they were a god, and so on. So in the ancient world, church and state, the rulers of the state, took on this kind of divine aspect. And Jesus is saying they're good, they're servants of God, yes, but not God. And you see times, well, for example, in the book of Acts, when the question's asked about when the state crosses the line, if you like, and calls for an obedience that belongs only to God. Let me show you. In the book of Acts, chapter 5, the apostles have been, Jesus' followers have been out preaching and so on about the fact they've seen Jesus risen from the dead. They're arrested. They're brought before the high priest in the city of Jerusalem, and they're told, Acts chapter 5, verse 28, "We gave you strict orders not to teach in this name," he said. That's the high priest speaking to them. "Yet you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching and are determined to make us guilty of this man's blood." Peter and the other apostles replied, "We must obey God rather than human beings." So somewhere out there is a line where, yes, generally you would obey the government and do as they ask and so on, but there is a line where, no, to do this would be to disobey God, and we will not do it. Very clearly they're about stop talking about Jesus, and they say, no, we will not. We want to push that around at question time and so on. Also, the New Testament is not naive about governments and so on. You see it actually happen in terms of persecution of Christians by different government authorities. The book of Revelation certainly points to that happening. So the New Testament is not naive about governments being purely good. Governments are capable of great evil. All right, a few thoughts and then let's push it around. If you're a Christian today in Australia, which way should you vote? Which is the Christian party? It's funny, really. I remember one federal election. It must be 15 years ago, something like that. There's two events happened within a day or two of each other that made me laugh. One is I went home and I saw my dear sweet mum, who still lives up the north coast. My grandfather worked for Doug Anthony, who was the leader of the Country Party, which became the National Party then. And that's kind of like in the DNA of our family, so you can imagine which way our family voted. And my mum's a dear, sweet Christian lady, said to me, "I'm worried about such and such up at the church." And I said, "What's his problem, Mum?" She said, "Well, he's an elder in our church," and she leant forward, looking, "and he votes for the Labor Party. How could anybody do that?" And I thought, well, yeah, okay. And so then I got on the plane and came back home, and I think it was the next day, I met a couple of my friends who were kind of a little alternative, kind of a little on the, you know, the hippie side. It's a while ago, you know, the close to the cheesecloth kind of skirt thing, and he had dreadlocks and so on. And I remember them saying something along the lines of, "How could anyone who calls himself a Christian vote for the Liberal Party, which is so heartless?" And I just, and what is that? That's two lots of people who are very committed Christians and yet have totally different political views. How does that happen? I think you can see how it happens. The Bible talks about all sorts of different issues that are important, okay, in life. The Bible deals with reality. It's complex. And because we bring different experiences and different priorities and backgrounds and so on to these problems, we'll see them differently as if you're a follower of Jesus. So let me give you a really basic example. It's really important that people are able to have work and jobs, isn't it? A healthy economy means that there's money around to care for people. It means that the not-for-profits do better. If people have jobs, they're much more likely to have stable life and so on. So a healthy economy, very important. But the environment's very important too, isn't it? And as Christians, you have an obligation to care for the planet. Sustainability is important. Now, depending on where you are and your back, you're going to see that very differently and so on, and which way you vote. Now, no one party is also going to have all the truth. We'll just see it differently. The Bible emphasises the idea of shared wealth and community responsibility, our responsibility to look after each other and distribute wealth. But the Bible also emphasises personal responsibility and reward for hard work. So which one of those is more important? And who do you vote for? And that's why Christians are able to disagree about priorities in politics. The Bible will, the Bible, I think, is equally happy with socialism or capitalism, but the Bible will critique the envy and laziness that comes with bad capitalism, and the Bible will critique the greedy and rapacious capitalist who just wants to exploit people. And how will you see it? Well, maybe your political views will say as much about you as about Jesus. But that's how we can disagree. A couple of last points. Should religious views be left out of the public square? Well, it depends what you mean by religion. Okay. People's worldview, everyone has a worldview that includes some belief about God, some belief about values, some belief about how people should be treated, some belief about priorities. Even the atheist brings, if you like, a religious view, and that is there's no God and so we should act this way. And so everyone brings their religious views into the public square. In fact, the great irony is those who say all religious views should be taken out of the public square say it in the public square because of their particular view about religion. So it's almost, as soon as someone cries out for that, it's self-defeating. No, no, everyone brings their religious views and values into the public square. Now, those in authority in terms of government should govern for the good of all people, but they'll inevitably bring their own values and so on. All right, one quick last point. Look at verses 16 and 17. They bought the coin, and he asked them, "Whose image?" Loaded word, image. "Whose image is this, and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. And Jesus said to them, "Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's." In other words, you give to Caesar what's in his image and give to God what is God's. If something has an image stamped on it, you can see who owns it. You can see who it belongs to. The coin belongs to Caesar. It has his image. Now, in the Bible's view of the world, what is it that has the image of God stamped onto it? Answer, well, it's us. Way back at the beginning of Genesis, Genesis 1:26, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and over all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. The Bible writers don't go on to fill in kind of by the numbers what the image means. Some people have said it's the fact that we're capable of relationship. Others have said that we're moral beings. Others have said that we're self-aware. Others have said, well, it's about us ruling the world kind of on behalf of God. My guess is there's elements of all of them as the Bible just kind of begins to paint the picture of humanity and so on. Now, the image of God idea gives us great value as people. That's where your value as a person comes from. We're made in the image of God. We're made actually to know our Creator. And so the image of God means God's made us, God owns us, our life and everything else comes from him. In fact, God invites us, even demands us, to come and know him through Jesus. Craig.
Thanks very much, Al.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.